Welcome to the Rosie on the House Arizona Hour, driven by Sanderson Ford.
Your weekend wake-up tradition for the last 30 years.
It's Rosie on the House.
You know, I've been a little hesitant to say it the last few months because it's dark out when we start the broadcast. But I now know why I don't ever have to worry about saying a beautiful Arizona good morning, ever.
Why is that?
Because no matter what happens outside, we're not negative 23 degrees with a lake of ice outside of our city. Have you seen the pictures from the Wall Street Journal, the Arizona Republic? Look at this fireman. It says he's covered in ice as he fights a blaze. What possible blaze is there when it's minus 23? Do you even need to fight it? Doesn't the weather just take care of it for itself?
Did you catch that, Julia, even, your sister? They had minus 55.
Even in Flagstaff and the White Mountains, Pine Top, Nutrioso, so the coldest parts of Arizona are not that miserable.
That's pretty miserable.
Negative 55 in Minneapolis?
Yep.
There's a poem, a Wisconsin poem. It's winter in Wisconsin. And the gentle breeze blow, 70 miles an hour at 35 below. Oh, how I love Wisconsin when the snow's up to your rear. You take a breath of air and your nose gets frozen shut. Yes, the weather here is wonderful, so I guess I'll hang around. I could never leave Wisconsin because I'm frozen to the ground. So, yes, it's dark outside and I haven't looked at the weather, but I'm telling you, welcome to a beautiful Arizona Saturday morning because you are not in Wisconsin. February's edition of Arizona Highways is all about the Grand Canyon National Park celebrating their 100th anniversary. On page 16, there's events of the century, a couple of them. This one I signed up for. It's a Mapping the Grand Canyon Conference at the end of the month at Arizona State University. And another one I want to get to, there's a Grand Canyon Star Party on the South Rim and North Rim in June. Now, I've stayed on the North Rim once at that little cottage that they take you to when you raft the Grand Canyon. They fly you in a little Cessna-type plane, and then they helicopter you down the next morning.
The ranch
into
up there.
The canyon. Mm-hmm. Well, that ranch, that was the darkest night I have ever experienced in my life on the North Rim. You couldn't see any kind of city glow from Vegas or any, and there was a no moon. I mean, just you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. I want to make it back up there for that. But they've got a lot of great things. The Native American Heritage Celebrations in August and November. That's all on page 16 and 17. And then on page 42 starts a really neat essay about the north side of the Grand Canyon. A lot of people go to the south side. You see the rim. You may hike down a little bit. Getting around to the north side is a lot more effort, but it's a completely different part of the Grand Canyon. If you've been to the South Rim a few times, next time you need to make a trip to the north. The elevation's a lot higher, so instead of looking across it, you're looking down, and there's a lot more forestry on the north side. So the Grand Canyon, that's February's Arizona Highways. If you don't subscribe, it's on newsstands now, but that's because it's celebrating its 100th anniversary. But you may not know, we're only a few days away from 101st anniversary of Arizona's deadliest gunfight. This is a story that producer Gary D found to us and put together a fascinating story. And there's a book has been written about it, along with a documentary, all from the research of Heidi Osler, who's in studio with us now. Thanks for, first of all, the incredible research you've put together for this.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about Arizona's deadliest gunfight.
Well, it took place in an unexpected place, remote location. It wasn't at the OK Corral in Tombstone. It wasn't in the Pleasant Valley War. Four people died in the Gloro Mountains in 1918 during World War I. And it happened when the Graham County Sheriff and two deputies and a federal marshal came up to arrest the gentleman at a mining camp for draft evasion. And at the end of the day, three of the lawmen were killed, and the father of the two draft evaders was also killed. And the boys left with a hired hand, Tom Sisson, Tom and John Power, on a manhunt.
And before we get into all the details about it, where'd you get the inspiration to write this?
About 6.5 years ago, Cameron Trejo came to me. He was doing a documentary. He had read Tom Powers' Shootout at Dawn, and he'd read the other side of the story written by a descendant of one of the sheriff. And he said, which account is true? And I kind of skimmed through them, and I said, boy, I don't think either one was. This is a story I could tell right away. We had to take it down to the studs. There was so much folklore intertwined into the story that, you know, we had to go and look at it fresh again. And that's what we did. And at the end of the day, when the documentary film was done, I said, well, I've got thousands of pages of research notes. I might as well do a book. And that's what happened.
And you can watch that documentary. It's on YouTube. We watched it this week. It has over 58,000 views. You would just look up Powers War, Wild West Forgotten History Documentary. And one of the impressive things about your book when you talk about it, I picked it up. I thought, oh, man, I'm not going to be able to get through all this before the interview. And I didn't. But I got a lot farther because of this 300-page book, the story ends at 225. You got 75 pages of all your references.
Yeah, I did spend quite a few years in archives, you know, just going through property records and tax records because there's so many variations of the story. Everyone wants to characterize the Powers as outlaws and thieves and other things. And actually, they didn't have any charges against them to speak of. They were never, you know, found guilty of any crimes. They were kind of a normal, very poor family. They lived in the hill country of Texas, and they were not educated, and they were poor. So I think their story was never told.
And how they got here kind of leads up to the events that happened on that February 10th morning.
Right. I think, you know, they wanted to live away from society. They were cattle ranchers. They were working a mine. They just didn't want to be part of the social crowd. And they wanted to be far away. But I think during World War I, that wasn't an option. You had to be a booster of the war. You had to be patriotic. And they weren't. They didn't sign up for the Red Cross or Liberty Bonds or all the things that were expected. But then the boys didn't sign up for the draft because they just felt they had to be home supporting their family, work in the mine. And if they were off in the trenches of Europe fighting, then their family would suffer.
They had lost their mom.
They had lost their mom when they were young. They were raised by their dad alone. There were four children in the family. I think the oldest was 11 when their mother died. Jeff Power was the patriarch of the family. His mother, their grandmother, helped raise them. And so they lived off the land. They grew their own crops, you know.
And just freak accidents. The mom died when a house collapsed.
Whipped on her head and crushed her.
And then the grandmother died from a runaway horse.
Yeah, but they also lived out in the sticks, and those kinds of accidents were frequent. And they lived in this tough terrain where horse accidents happened often. So I think that was, yeah, it was very tragic, but not unusual. And then, of course, the death that really triggered everything was the death of Ola Mae Power, the youngest member of the family, when she was just 23. We still don't know how she died.
Mm. And so you're left with a dad, two sons, and a hired hand living remotely in these mountains with this chain of tragedy over the last decade. You're pretty hardened.
Yes. They're living in a place where the nearest neighbor is several miles away, and those are miners. They're living in a tiny shack that's, you know, 15 by 20 feet, and there are bears and there's mountain lions. And on Sunday morning before dawn in winter, they heard a noise outside. What would you do if you were living in those circumstances and you heard the dogs barking and the horses making a ruckus?
Well, same thing I do at home, grab the double barrel and go see what's going on.
Yeah, Jeff Power grabbed his Winchester, walked out the door, and found himself face to face with a couple of deputies. And they did not identify themselves. They said, throw up your hands. And there's some dispute as to what happened after that. Obviously, the two sides had different versions. But it seems as though he was trying to surrender to them. But then shooting broke loose, and he went down first. He was shot through the chest, through the lung, and he would die later that day. And his boys inside said, you know, later on, they shot down our pa. You'd fight back, too, if you were in the similar circumstances.
Especially if you didn't know who you were fighting. And
exactly.
You said they were unidentified. Whether it was an intentional or accidental fire, I mean, you just...
I suspect things got out of control real quickly. It was dark out.
It was dark, like it is right now.
It was
in a canyon. Mm-hmm. The first shot, they say, was around 7:30, only 15 minutes from now.
Right.
Take the outside light and put it in a canyon.
And it was
They've been
overcast.
Traveling all mm-hmm. night, so they're already tired, probably a little bit. Your nerves are shaking. Mm-hmm. The lawmen themselves weren't even over 30. I mean, it could have just been a shaking hand on a trigger, whether it was an intentional or accidental, but the first shot rang out, the dad goes down, the three men in the cabin fight back.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think for me, when I was looking at all the stories that had been written about this, they all focused on who ambushed who. You know, the lawman set up an ambush to kill the powers, to get their mind, was one theory. The other theory was that these people, the power families, were hardened criminals. They killed their own sister to hide that criminality. And there's really no evidence of either side of those stories. But I understood pretty quickly that maybe there were some other factors at play here, that it wasn't a feud. They weren't fighting over a valuable gold mine or anything like that. Because quite frankly, when the gold mine went up for auction, it sold... Nobody bid on it, so I don't think it was as valuable as they all like to think.
I saw somewhere, I don't know if it was in the documentary or the book, but total out of the mine, they've only ever pulled like 53 ounces of gold,
right.
Which in today's value is less than $70,000.
And it was such a remote area to haul ore out of there.
It cost $100,000 to mine it.
Exactly. They spent the last 2 years just trying to build a trail up there to get equipment in, so...